and welcome to the Please See Attached podcast, where we delve into everything digital marketing and discuss the strange, wonderful, and sometimes dangerous ways in which the internet has been shaping our lives. I'm Steve Gould, and I host this podcast along with my colleagues Daphna Ben-Yehoshua, Jensen Lee, and Matt Plouffe. And today, we have a very special guest who will be joining in on the discussion, our intern, Sammy. Welcome, Sammy. In today's episode, we dive into some common marketing acronyms. If you're just getting into digital marketing, you've probably heard a bunch of those already. SEO, PPC, SEM, ROI, CPC, CPM, CPA. Sometimes you may feel your SOL when you don't understand them, but today we're going to discuss some of the more common ones and their significance for digital marketing. But before we begin, let's take a quick walk down digital memory lane. Remember when? Remember the days before streaming services? Remember when we had to rely on what was on TV and downloading stuff or DVDs? Do you miss those times? Let's start off with Daphna. What's your memory of before streaming?
I was watching a lot of stuff for sure. You know, I remember the days of just like TV and then getting cable, satellite TV. So like slowly getting more options while I was growing up, and then DVDs. But I remember in university, you know, people were starting to download stuff through all those like illegal downloading platforms. And I was doing a lot of that too, you know, but now it's all streaming. And yeah, I definitely watch many, many more shows and films than I'd ever watched before.
Do you pay for cable services right now, or you just use a few different streaming services?
No, I just use a few different streaming services.
Yeah, it's really different. I mean, I remember my first trip to Israel, which was in the early 80s. And it was 1979. I'd correct myself there. But there was nothing on TV there. We watched Hawaii Five-0. And that was like the only thing in English that we could find. It was really strange.
There was one channel.
Yeah.
There was only one channel, I think. And then in the early 90s, they added a second channel. That was super exciting.
It's crazy. I mean, we had tons of TV, but you had to look in the TV guide and be right there at 8 o'clock and, you know, get the channel and make sure you had cable and push the right buttons. And then into downloading things, I remember those illegal sites when they first started and how long it would take to download stuff. But now it's crazy what's out there. But Jensen, you are like the king of this world. What's your take on it?
I don't know if I miss it per se, but there's some nostalgia to the days of the DVD and VHS. I don't know about you guys, but one of my fondest memories is going back to Blockbuster. And every Friday night, you walk through the movie aisles and pick up a couple movies, a treat, some popcorn, something that I still do with my partner now, except using streaming services. So yeah, I'm just obviously...
It's a long stroll down those streaming aisles.
It is, totally.
Those Blockbuster trips, gents, those were always great. And you remember how freaking busy Blockbuster would be on a Friday or Saturday night? Like, it was jammed. And I used to...
Remember when new releases would come out and there'd be like two whole sections that was just that one movie and there were no copies,
always gone. But you know what the trick was? You go hang out by the return cart, and as people bring them in, they would put them on the return cart. I would snag stuff off that cart all the time.
Yeah, I'm still a fan of tangible media, so I still have a very large Blu-ray and DVD collection. But it's definitely more convenient to look up a movie on Netflix and Prime versus like rummaging through DJ cases that I have full of DVDs and Blu-rays to watch something. So yeah.
When's the last time you put a DVD in your machine?
Actually, you know what? I have the Criterion Collection of the Before series, so I actually put that on recently.
Yeah, for me, it was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. After we watched Ratchet, we watched the original movie, and I had it on DVD, so I said, why not? But Sammy, what do you got to say? You're like the Gen Z, so I don't even think that you have any memory of not streaming.
I still do have memories of actually walking through Blockbuster as a kid with my family and looking for movies, so I definitely actually do miss that. But yeah, at my cottage, we still have a VHS, so we still watch all our old VHS movies. So it's a lot of nostalgia there. Yeah, I'm still on Crave and Amazon Prime and Netflix now, so it makes it a lot easier.
Yeah, for sure it does. Yeah, the cottage is always a good place to watch movies, you know, when you find those old copies. Well, VHS, I mean, what are you guys watching on VHS up there? All your old Disney movies? Those things are worth money. You should be, you know, looking to sell them from the vault. So great. Thanks, guys. Let's move on to Matt and see what he has to say about downloading, streaming, etc.
I feel like I was an early adopter of Napster. I know the first album I ever downloaded was Dr. Dre 2001 The Chronic.
That's a good one.
Or, yeah. And it came out, I think, like months after Napster actually came out. Seeing that that was one of my first downloads, I claim to be an early adopter. But I've always been a big music head. So having that ease of access to downloading music through Napster or LimeWire or all the other tools that came out over the years after Sean Parker and Napster became a thing, I was definitely avid on those things. But when it comes to DVDs and movies, I think I was a big fan of the DVD box sets, like The Wire, Arrested Development. I remember that was on constantly in first year in my dorm room, and Band of Brothers. That was one of the best shows ever made, I would say.
I have that box set. I've watched it a few times. It's in a tin, and fantastic, fantastic series. Awesome. And now we're going to take a little break. We'll be right back. Do you feel like you need some color in your life? Are you looking to snazz up your work from home outfit? Well, you've got to check out Color Riot at mycolorriot.com. It's a Toronto-based fashion brand that creates unique tie-dye casual wear. You can customize your own color combination and tie-dye style, or choose from the Color Riot favorites. With 27 colors to choose from, you can create your very own signature hoodie, t-shirt, sweatpants, and super totes. Upgrade your basics with tie-dye pieces at mycolorriot.com and get a 15% discount with the code PSA. Remember, it's color with a U. Awesome. All right. Well, thank you guys. Let's get into the topic of the day. All those marketing acronyms. There are so many of them. Some of them sound so similar, like CPC and PPC or SEO and SEM. Today, we're going to try and clear up some of that confusion by explaining some of the more common ones. So we all kind of split these up and we're going to form it into a discussion, and hopefully it's helpful for our listeners. Matt, why don't you give us a starting point with one of the big ones, ROI.
So ROI is return on investment. So you're looking at how much you spent on a campaign based on how much you've earned from that spend. So generally what you're looking for is profits from a campaign. If you spend $1 and make $2, that means you got 100% return on investment. That being said, it doesn't always work out that way. And the dollar values can fluctuate quite significantly from 1 week to 1 month to 1 year to another. So when you're looking at ROI, there's actually kind of a calculation to it. So you take your net profits, divide it by the cost of the investment, and multiply it by 1,000. It's a simple percentage calculation that just wants to tell you how much you made, positive or negative, based on the investment that you put into your campaign.
Would you say that ROI is one of the key things that our clients are always looking for?
Definitely. I don't think a lot of them ask for it in that kind of detail. I think a lot of small businesses just want to see it sort of in trends where they just see numbers going up. They don't necessarily always want to know the ROI based on what they spent. It is a valuable metric and one that we provide to our clients based on their media spend, and then look at sort of what business it actually brings. But it is also hard to dictate that from just online marketing, because sometimes we're driving traffic to a brick and mortar location. Sometimes we're getting people to pick up the phone and call locations. And if you can't actually track that as a conversion or as a lead from the analytics or tools that we have, it's hard to translate it perfectly. So unless you're doing some sort of...
you're not going to get a true ROI.
Exactly. Unless you're doing some sort of code or coupon, like a sale or something along those lines that references that promotion, it's very hard to determine it as a perfect science.
Cool. Yeah. Well, it is an important one. I know lots of clients want to know that they're getting a return on their investment in their marketing spend. ROI for sure is a KPI. So why don't we take a look at a key performance indicator? This is a big one, I think. You know, you often hear people refer to KPIs tied to the overall success of a campaign. I think it's important to select the business or performance metrics prior to starting your campaign so that the KPIs can be measured. You know, we'll go with our clients and talk to them about the campaign that they're going to have and what kind of KPIs they're looking to have and some of the top KPIs in the digital world. And feel free to add in when I'm finished here, guys, but would be web traffic, brand awareness, cost per lead, cost per conversion, click-through rates, returning visitors, and obviously overall ROI that we just talked about. And then another interesting one is ROAS. So maybe Daphne, you can give us a shot at that.
Yeah, absolutely. So ROAS means return on ad spend. So it can sound similar to ROI, which as Matt said, is return on investment, but it's kind of more granular because it actually refers to, looks more at specific ads, specific campaigns, or any initiatives, and only considers advertising costs. So basically ROAS is how much your business earns in revenue for every dollar spent on advertising. And you would calculate it by dividing the revenue generated by the campaign by the amount you spend on that campaign. So for example, if you spend $1,000 on your ad campaign and made $10,000 in revenue from that campaign, that's a ROAS of 10, 10,000 divided by 1,000. And a ROAS is just basically a good way to measure how effective your advertising efforts are. So really seeing, the exact return you get on every dollar you put into advertising.
That's great. Is there a standard ROAS that clients look for, that we aim for when we're working campaigns?
I think it really changes from industry to industry, but I've seen online just like researching this, that a good number, kind of a baseline number to look for, is a ROAS of 4. So anything 4 or above would be considered good.
That's great. It's interesting. I never knew what that one was. I used to hear you guys talk about that and I'm like, what the heck is that? I need to look it up. So thanks for clearing that one up for us. I think maybe let's go to some of the most popular ones. Matt, why don't you give us your take on SEO and SEM?
Definitely. So SEO is probably one of my favorite things in the digital world, which is search engine optimization. And the best way to break this down is when you search something, there are 4 different areas of real estate on the Google search page. Usually on the top, there's going to be Google Ads. Sometimes if you're looking for locations or sort of things near me, there's also going to be Google Maps locations. So those are sort of the first 2 pieces that pop up on most searches. And then the third is going to be the organic results. And this is where you're going to see sort of the 10 pages. You know, when you search on Google and then there's the G-O-O-O-O-O-O-O-O-O-O-O for however many pages there might be. All of those pages are organic results. It's also funny that it's O with organic results, but page after page of these organic results are going to be there. We all trust and use Google because we know that it is going to give us the results that we are looking for based on the query that we're inputting. So having Google provide us with the most relevant results based on our search is search engine optimization. So a lot of websites and companies will try to make sure that their website communicates as clearly as possible to Google what they offer and what they do. Now, there's a bunch of different ways that you can do this, and that's search engine optimization. So it's basically trying to get your web page to rank on the higher pages of Google through organic results.
Now, from what I know about SEO, back in the Wild West early days of the internet, you could do stuff like hide keywords in behind your website over and over and over and over and over again.
Yep. Or a big one was using the same color font as your background. So if you had a white web page wallpaper, you would put white font sort of scattered through the footer or behind an image that was overlaid over top of it or something like that. So yeah, there were definitely black hat SEO tricks that were used or are now considered black hat SEO. When it was the Wild West, this was not something that was regulated. But nowadays, there's a lot of different black hat tricks that can definitely boost your website and your SEO rankings very, very quickly. But if you get caught doing these, or if you get busted by the Googlebot on these types of tactics, you can be sort of banned from organic search results forever. So it's not necessarily worth the risk to be doing these kinds of things. And some of them are easier to do than others, but at the same time, none of them are worth it, in my opinion.
No, you need to play by the rules in this day and age. And obviously, that's where a professional agency can come in and help you through these kind of tricky SEO routes. Cool. What about SEM?
So SEM is search engine marketing. Now, it's a little confusing because organic optimization is search engine usage. but there's no paid placement for your website on organic. How SEM differentiates is that you are paying for ad space within Google Ads or Bing Ads, whatever search engine you might be using. So by putting forth the budget, you are then paying for your website to have a placement in that top section that I was discussing before. So in the three sections, there's the ad section, the map section, and the organic section. SEM is that ad section. So that's where you are putting your dollars to show up on that top of the page immediately. It doesn't take any added work outside of having a website, setting up a Google Ads account, then paying money to get yourself in that space. This is generally the easiest way to gain immediate returns on search engine marketing, as it is allowing you to put your website or your service in front of the individual that is searching for that keyword or that service. So it is usually an intent-based objective when it comes to online digital marketing, because people have to be looking for it. If I was selling flowers and someone is searching, where can I buy flowers, I would be targeting those kinds of keywords and bidding for a placement within those ad spaces when those keywords are searched.
Perfect. And SEM, obviously a huge part, but there are definitely some built-in complexities to the world of SEM in particular with how you bid on words, keywords, etc. And that is the science behind it. What does PPC mean and how does it relate to all of these?
So PPC goes hand in hand with search engine marketing. So the way that Google has set up their ad campaigns, or the way that you pay for their ads, is you pay for the click. So you actually don't pay just to show up on the first page. You only pay when someone clicks on your ad and is driven to your website. Now, if someone clicks on the ad and didn't mean to do it and goes back immediately, most of the time Google will actually credit you back for the cost of those types of clicks. It's not a perfect science by any means, but they are not necessarily trying to rip you off for the dollars that you have within your campaign. The way it works with Google is that it's actually, as Steve was saying, and I was saying before, it's a bidding system. So you're looking at how much you're trying to spend and you're bidding against other individuals who might be competing for those keywords as well. So if I'm a flower shop and I'm bidding on flowers, every other flower shop is going to be bidding on flowers. But if I do custom geranium bouquets and I want to target those keywords, a lot less people are going to be trying to bid on keywords such as custom bouquet geraniums. So it's going to be a lot more affordable to show up on those types of searches, but people are going to search it a little less often. So it costs a little less for those types of keywords than main keywords or high value keywords.
It's the beauty of digital advertising. It's a pay-per-click model. So unless somebody actually clicks, you're not paying, but you have to make sure your bid is in line with the market in order to get the people to click and drive them to your website. So it's certainly a complex relationship that takes some experience to make sure it works well. But in the end, the client does get good value for their money, because usually if somebody clicks, they click with intent and hopefully it turns into a conversion. That was great. Thanks, Matt. So let's just change gears for a little bit because we've been doing a lot of that. And let's move over to Sammy, the intern with UX and UI.
Yeah, so the term user experience, although it kind of sounds pretty complicated, it's really just the experience that someone has when they're encountering a product, whether it be an app, a website, or service. So the role of a UX designer is pretty much to find out where these problems are occurring, why they're occurring, and through different methods of research, they figure out the best possible methods to fixing these problems so it's more user-friendly and efficient for the user. User interface is a little bit different. It's concerned more with the look and the feel of the app or product or website or whatever is being designed. And the user interface designer is really responsible for making sure everything is coded correctly and there's good contrast and good hierarchy with the typography. And pretty much the back-end coding is done properly, but UX and UI really do coincide a lot of the time. They work together, and larger businesses actually invest in both a UX and a UI designer, but smaller businesses usually just have one combined role, but they really are quite similar.
Can you give us an example of like a UX issue a website would have that we need to be fixed?
Yeah, sure. So a UX issue that might occur is error prevention. So let's say someone is trying to type a password and they're not really typing in the correct credentials for what has to be typed in for that password. If that specific website doesn't have instructions on exactly what needs to be done for that password, then the user will get quite frustrated and most likely exit the app. Another example of a common UX mistake is the navigation. So if it doesn't have proper navigation and it's not taking the user exactly where they want to go, and if it's not laid out properly so that the user instinctively knows where to go when they're using that product, then there is a problem that needs to be fixed.
Thanks for that, Sammy. That was really good. Daphna, let's move on to some of yours, starting with CPC and just let it go.
Yeah, so this ties back into what Matt was explaining about SEM and PPC and basically paid marketing. So CPM, CPC, CPA, all of those, you know, they start with the letter C, which stands for cost, and they all refer to different advertising models. So if we start with CPC, that means cost per click. So that's a model where the advertiser pays every time someone clicks on the ad. Normally, a click on the ad is a click through to the website. So users clicking on the ad would get to the brand's website. Doesn't necessarily mean they've taken any action on the website, just that they viewed it through clicking on the ad. But CPC is a good metric to determine how competitive your ad is compared to ads from competitors, like similar brands. You always want to maintain a low cost per click because that means that more people are clicking your ad, so you need to pay less. So that's good, obviously. And then the way you would calculate it is by dividing your total ad spend, so the total money you're spending on the ad, by the total number of clicks. So that's CPC. Another common one is CPM, which means cost per mil, and mil is the Latin word for 1,000. So basically it means cost per 1,000 impressions. Now impressions are the views that an ad receives. So basically how many times that ad has been displayed or viewed. And when you use CPM, so that's where the advertiser would pay for 1,000 times the ad has been displayed to users. And you would choose CPM if your goal is brand awareness, because you want more people to see your ad. You want to spread the word, spread the message about your brand. Then to calculate CPM, you would divide your total ad spend by the total number of ad impressions, and then you would multiply that by 1,000 to get the number. And then another common one is CPA. So that can mean either cost per action or cost per acquisition. And that's where you pay, where the advertiser pays for each specific action a user takes. Usually the action refers to something that's related to sales, like a purchase on the website. But sometimes advertisers want to measure different actions, like signups, for example, or different button clicks, like clicking on the add to cart button. Then you can use CPA to figure out how much you want to spend for this action you want people to take. And then you would calculation is kind of similar to the other ones. You would take the total amount of money you spend on the ad, then divided by the total number of actions or conversions that this ad generated. Yeah, so those are the common three C's. We usually see in ad campaigns. Yeah.
Just to go back to CPM, that's kind of the one that carried over from traditional marketing and advertising. You know, if you were buying an ad in a newspaper or a magazine, they would always base the rate on the cost per thousand, you know, how many subscribers they have and how many people are going to see it on this network or this platform, whatever it is. So, you know, there is some traditional marketing still in these acronyms, but obviously a lot has changed with the world of digital. You know, we're going to go backwards in the alphabet now and go to the ones that start with B. A very common one we hear and use every week is B2B, and it's business to business, you know. And I guess the best way to describe this one is thinking of car manufacturing, and every car has parts from other companies or computers. You know, Samsung will sell a computer with an Intel processor. The transaction that Samsung takes place of buying a processor from Intel is a B2B transaction. It's business to business, very basic. But in the world of digital, we do often come across clients that are in that B2B world, and we have to come up with campaigns that can help help them build their B2B business. And it's certainly something that we are familiar with and have clients working on that currently. And then we go B2C. And this is more typical. It's business selling directly to consumers or customers. And, you know, you see this everywhere. You buy a Panasonic TV from Best Buy. It's B2C. You know, you're going out as a consumer or a customer and you're buying something from a business. This is obviously way more common in terms of everyday transactions, e-commerce, et cetera. But, you know, it is an acronym. To continue on that, we're going to skip the C and go to D. And, you know, Daphna put this list together and I'm like, D2C? What the heck is that? Because we hadn't really done anything but with D2C. But it's a bit of a difference here as you take out the middleman. So it would be no Best Buy, you know, buy Apple from Apple. Or, you know, Amazon has their own branded products and you buy from Amazon. So it's more margin for the brand by removing the middleman. So it's direct to consumers. That's it.
Yeah, I want to add, can I just add that a lot of MLMs use D2C.
Oh, the old multi-level marketing, Amway or Scamway.
Yeah.
And then there's...
That's a good example.
It's a great
D2C.
Example. There's so many of those MLMs still out there. And then C2C. So for this one, think Craigslist, Kijiji, Facebook Marketplace. It's consumers to consumers. So you're selling as a consumer, you're selling something to another consumer, customer to customer. Could be products or services. So even freelancers selling their specialty services in this gig economy, it's kind of C2C as well. You know, I'm going to leave CLV till the end because it's a weird one for me. Sammy, let's finish up with yours and UGC because I don't know what that one is.
Sure. UGC is user-generated content, which is pretty much any content, texts, videos, images, reviews that are created by people like the customers rather than the actual brand. And brands often share UGC on their own social media accounts and websites because it's good marketing for them when they post, let's say, like a testimonial from people's social media accounts, because it really helps build trust within the brand and helps consumers drive their purchasing decisions. Because if they see that a friend posted a photo about a product that they really liked, then they're most likely to get a product that their friend posted rather than any random product. So it's really important for businesses to have a good user-generated content strategy to help get their product out there. Some common ones now are the use of influencers, TikTok, it's really big, and just promotions and giveaways are also really big.
Yeah, UGC, I think, is a really important part of people's businesses these days, if they're pushing products, especially, I mean, services too, but to have your users give you positive feedback and great content is like, I can't even come up with the proper gigantic word to describe how powerful it can be for a brand. So yeah, UGC, that's an important one. Thank you, Sammy, for enlightening me. It's huge. Daphna, let's finish up with the CTR, CR, CTAs.
All right. Yeah, so I'll start with CDR and CR because they're kind of connected. Going back to the SEM and PPC, so those are also measures, metrics you would see for your ads performance. And CDR means click-through rate. So it's the ratio of clicks to impressions. And as I said previously, impressions are the views of your ad. So how many clicks your ad received compared to the impressions it received. So for example, if your ad had 100 impressions, was seen 100 times, and 5 of those people clicked on it, then the click-through rate would be 5%. And you always want to keep your CDR high because it means people that see your ads are finding them relevant and then they're clicking on them. So that's pretty important metric. You know, when we look at the campaigns we do for our clients, that's one we always look at. And then CR, conversion rate, that's also an important one for campaigns that are, the objective is conversions. That would be the number of conversions on a website divided by the number of visitors to the website. And conversion can really be anything you decide is a conversion. So it can be a purchase on the website. It can be a sign up. It can be every time someone clicked on a button like add to cart or sign up. So for example, if your website had 100 visitors in a month and made 5 sales, and that's the conversion you want to track. So the conversion rate would be 5 divided by 100, which would be 2% conversion rate. And the conversion rate really helps you understand understand the performance of your website. So let's say you get a good number of visitors, but very few conversions. It likely means that you need to optimize something in the process because people are obviously interested in your website, but something is happening that is preventing them from making that conversion. So it could be a UX issue, for example, like Sammy said, that could be one of the things. And then the last one I wanted to talk about, which is kind of related to all marketing campaigns and just like content in general online, is a CTA, which is call to action. Call to action is the action you want your audience to take, whether it's an ad or on your website or on your app or any kind of content you put out. Even, you know, not necessarily digital marketing, even out of home advertising or TV commercials have a call to action. So when an ad has a buy now button, that's a CTA. Or when the website encourages user to sign up to the newsletter, that's a CTA as well. So let's say the website sells gardening tools. So a CTA on the website could be, do you want to get more gardening tips to your inbox? Subscribe to our newsletter. That's a CTA. So a CTA can be direct CTA, which is like very sales oriented, like buy now, or it can be a softer CTA, like learn more or download or sign up. Yeah. And then, you know, CTAs are super important for any marketing campaign. And you always want to keep your CTA clear and concise and like really follow a marketing message. It needs to be conspicuous on the ad or website. So it's really important people see the CTA in order to, you know that they have to do that action. Yeah, and I would say a good strategy is to really try to include CTAs in every type of content you put out, like whether it's the website or your ads, obviously they need to have a CTA, your newsletter, social posts, even the ones that are not ads, just like regular social posts. So that's a really important one.
Well, yeah, because you want to get your audience to interact with your platform. And this is what you're talking about with the CTA, is getting them to interact in one way, shape, or form, whether it's actually a direct purchase or signing up for something just to further their interest in your product, which kind of ties into the last one, which is CLV. And I found this one really interesting because it's the customer lifetime value. And really, all of us as consumers, what are we worth to a business or a platform over our lifetime interacting with their product or service? It measures the amount of gross profit that we as consumers provide to a company over the entire time we do business with them. So, you know, it's very important to a business because they got to make decisions on how much they're going to spend on marketing, advertising. Sales teams will often use CLV to find out how much money they can spend on acquiring, engaging, or retaining customers while still making a profit. There is a formula. I'm not going to go through it because it's a little more not as straightforward as the other ones. I'm happy to talk about it offline with anybody who's interested. And yeah, so, you know, to me, all of these things are KPIs, key performance indicators. They're all important to the overall information and data that we collect on behalf of our clients with their campaigns. And the data and the analysis of the data has become so important in our digital world. We often say that to our clients, we often say that your success is our success, and we can measure it. We can actually measure the success and we can show it to you. We're not trying to pull the wool over anybody's eyes here. We're trying to make sure that we use the right pieces for each client individually, show them the data, analyze it, optimize it, and together, you know, we will come up with a fantastic campaign. So that's it. Of course, there are many more acronyms, but we tried to focus on the main ones. And, you know, it seems like a lot already, but wait, there's more. If you're interested in learning some of these, a simple Google search for marketing acronyms would bring up many online articles that you can look into on your own. So it's almost time to say goodbye. But before we do, let's play a little game we like to call Would You Rather? The digital yardstick. Would you rather never go to a restaurant again or never order food on a delivery app again? You know, it's funny, a lot of these things always come down to food, and you think that, you know, we are all these crazy food people, and we are. So, you know, it makes a lot of sense. Sammy, what do you think, buddy? You know, never go to a restaurant again or never order food on a delivery app again?
I'm going to have to say never go to a restaurant again. just because I'm in university and there are a lot of late nights where I'm quite hungry and I don't think I could walk to the restaurant. So it's definitely helpful to have Uber Eats around.
Wait, do bars count as restaurants?
Ooh, no.
Because that might change for a university student.
No, we're not going to count bars as restaurants here. So, you know, you can still go to the bar. You just can't eat there. You're only going to drink. But you're going to pre-drink at home anyways. I know how it works.
Yeah.
But that's when we can all go back out in public again.
Hopefully soon enough.
All right, Sammy.
Well, you can still pre-drink your Zoom calls.
Exactly.
It would make them so much more fun. Matt, what about you, Mr.
Feeny? I'd probably give up the delivery app, as convenient as it can be. It is definitely more expensive than going to the restaurant. I also assume that going to the restaurant means I could still like pick up my dinner or food from a restaurant and bring it home. So that I have nothing against that. But I just think the restaurant experience and being able to, you know, even on a higher level, being able to go to restaurants with amazing chefs and different coursed meals, not that I do that often, but just having the option to be able to sit down, eat something that was prepared for you on the plate that it was served on, and having it fresh is an experience that I miss dearly right now. And I don't think any free delivery services wouldn't compare to that experience.
Yeah, for sure. I get it. It's the experience factor. Daphne, what do you say?
Yeah, I think I would also choose going to restaurants. Again, like this is one of the things I like doing the most, actually, in pre-COVID times. So I really miss it now. You know, just going out, checking out new restaurants, you know, new dishes. It's something I really, really like doing. I'm kind of compensating it for it now by, you know, ordering a lot of food online. But yeah, I could live without it. I mean, again, as Matt said, you could go to the restaurant and pick it up. You can always call the restaurant to order your food. So yeah, I would choose the physical restaurant experience.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to chime in here for me. I agree with you guys on that one. I think I would give up the app. Honestly, I don't use it that much, but I do, like you guys, miss the experience of being able to go out and have somebody prepare food for me instead of me preparing food for somebody, and getting the service and the drinks and the conversation and the atmosphere and all of that that we especially miss these days because of pandemic life. But even, you know, regardless of pandemic, I would choose keeping my ability to go to a restaurant. Jensen, take us out of this.
Yeah, I would definitely choose going to a restaurant over a delivery app. Kind of like Daphne, one of my favorite things to do is to go to a restaurant and try new things. But it's also the connecting with friends and having a good meal with friends, and just that social aspect that I miss terribly since the pandemic started as well. So the second COVID's over, I'm definitely going to restaurants and hanging out with my friends again.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you, guys. Just a quick little note here. As we've been recording this episode today, it's January 6th, and there's some historic happenings going on while this is happening right this minute that, you know, I thought it'd be interesting just to point out that the Capitol building in Washington is being stormed right now by anti or pro-Trump supporters in this whole electoral college and approving the vote. So it is, you know, on top of pandemic, we have some crazy historical moments happening south of the border, and hope everybody's staying safe. So thanks for listening today, guys. And what about you? What would you rather do? We'd love to hear from you about your choice and your reasons for it, and we'll share our favorite answers on one of our next episodes. You can mail us at psa@getonboard.ca. Also, you can follow us on social to get an update on when our next episode airs. Our Facebook is Please See Attached. Our Instagram is @please.c.attached. That's it for the episode. We hope you've enjoyed the show. If you like the episode, don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. See you on the next episode of Please See Attached. Bye-bye.